Welcome to Candidly Speaking. This time up, we are excited to have with us the author of Your Evolving Soul, The Cosmic Spirituality of the Urantia Revelation. Byron Belitzos is a leading exponent of the Urantia book. He's been trained in philosophy, psychology, history, and theology. He's also a publisher, editor, and co-author of numerous acclaimed and award-winning books, including many related to the Urantia Revelation. He joins us, Byron Belitzos, our guest this week on Candidly Speaking. Why should mankind in the current age care about something as esoteric as the soul?
Good question, and thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. You know, it's said to be esoteric by those who are kind of on the outside looking in, who are in the sort of the materialistic technological age, that it's all about what's outside and not so much what's inside, and it's really, we want to reverse that picture and begin from the inside out. Doesn't mean we don't go from the outside in, but we're weighing things back in the other direction of the inner life, of course, and with the Urantia Revelation, all the wisdom traditions are telling us the same thing, that it's about the growth of the person, the spiritual growth of the person, but the soul is the place to focus when we think about the inner life, because that's the part of our inner life that we manage, that we with our decision making power can co-create, versus other parts of the self which we don't, we are not in control of these things, such as we don't control the thought adjuster, you know, the, mm-hmm. the spirit self within. It's self-acting in many cases, or, you know, it's certainly infallible in all cases. We receive our personality from the Father, and it's, in a certain sense, it's arbitrary, and we don't control the unique personality that we receive. And the mind is, yes, we have intellectual growth, but the capacity of the mind is an endowment from, as we're told, from the Divine Mother, from Mother Spirit. But the soul is within the arena of choice, of course. And so we want to focus on who we are, what we're growing into become. And we know from the Urantia book that we're growing toward perfection. So in the book, I really break it into two aspects. There's what I call soul making, and then the other aspect is self perfecting. And those two, I think, encompass all of the efforts that we have within. But getting back to your question, you know, why is this important? It's because it's the only asset you have that you take with you into the afterlife. And we're so focused on our life here, but, you know, we have an eternal life. And, you know, we are kind of little rocket ships that are going up into the heavens. And what the kind of the payload of the ship is, that you're really carrying, that's special, is your most precious asset, mm-hmm. your soul, your evolving soul. So that's one way to answer that question.
Well, you covered several different things all at once, forms, if you will, the personality, the spirit, the soul. And from my perspective, or perspective I think is fairly common, when you observe people today, most people are spiritually, I think, illiterate. Not that it's their fault. A lot of it is cultural. But sometimes I don't know if people understand what the differences are between those entities, I guess. So let's break it down if we could, because you do go into this about the triad and the different elements that constitute our very selfhood. So for a lot of people, they don't know what's the difference between the spirit and the soul. So could you, in layman terms, explain what the difference is, what differentiates between the soul and the spirit, and then also the personality and all of the constituent parts of our being?
Oh, thank you for another big question.
Yeah, long question, too.
the breakdown, you know, the distinction between the soul and the spirit, you would have thought would have been worked out by the ancients, by in the scriptures, and by Christian, you know, the Christian New Testament, and it was not. It actually became obscured in comparison to some ancient teachings. For example, Egyptian teachings had a better distinction between the spirit and the soul, and that did come into, you know, Mediterranean religious culture, but it was lost, and I think it's very telling that that this fundamental distinction is not present in today's, you know, Christianity, and certainly not in other religions with any clarity. So, getting to basics, the spirit is the God fragment that is given to us. I believe it you know, is clearly, you know, clear to us in the Urantia Revelation that it is not given at birth. It is given when a child is ready for it. The child is ready for it when they have their first moral decision. That's when they have what we call moral autonomy status.
So, for example, so choosing not to steal a piece of candy, or knowing that somebody did something wrong, maybe a sibling, and trying to wrestle with whether they should tell somebody, that kind of a moral decision?
Yeah, that kind of moral decision, like, you know, well, I guess I'll share this toy with my brother, but I've been, you know, hoarding it, but, you know, maybe I should do it, you know? So mm-hmm. they get this impulse that is the first sign of the true independent moral thought, because these are thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So the thought adjuster, this God fragment, is comes very quietly, very silently. It's a real huge cosmic event, and it's an evidence that the universe is watching every little child. And so this God fragment is pure deity, pure God, we're taught. And in Christianity, there is some sense of this. They call it the pneuma, you know, which is the word we get. Pneumonia, right? Breath.
Mm-hmm.
And so this pneuma, as they call it, is identified as distinct from the psyche. We get the word psychiatry, and that is distinguished in some biblical passages. And so the soul is, the, again, as I was saying earlier, is that part that is the co-created entity from the moment that one has the God fragment. When the God fragment is now present, then a alchemical process can occur that is sort of the God fragment is the spark plug, and the combustion is in the engine is provided, the energy, the fuel for that, you might say, is provided by from above, from the thought adjuster, but also from below, from the moral choices that this child is now making. So the mind of that child, that the material mind, is now has the capacity to choose among options, and that also contributes to the combustion.
Mm-hmm. And in the book, you describe it as a co-creative process where you've really got a partnership between the experiencing person, which is you or me, and then the spirit component of it is actually a fragment of God or the light of life or, you know, whatever the term is. And these two entities form one entity, infusion, for lack of a better term, and that is the soul. So in essence, our life here is, our soul really is in an embryonic form during our short life on Earth, correct?
Yeah, it's an embryo of something that will become mature. And I think, you know, we get some relative soul maturity in this life, but not, you know, relative to the afterlife. It's, you know, we're like infants
mm-hmm.
in our soul development. And so the soul, of course, is an energetic reality. It's in substance, it is very distinct from the God fragment, right? The God fragment is pure spirit. The soul is Marantia, as we say in the Arantia book, of course, and Marantia is the energy that intervened, that is in the mid-mind, so to speak, as the midwayers use the phrase. So it's not the material mind, and it's not the spirit self. It is in between. It is a distinct, logically distinct subject, entity from everything else. It has its own status and standing in the universe, distinct from the spirit self, distinct from the personality of the person. And I insist on that, at least from my studies, that the personality is a distinct substance from the spirit, which is distinct from the soul. And these three distinct substances are yet work together as one in a system. But we need to tease out their differences in order to understand how that system works. I call it the self system. We almost miss it when we study the Urantia Revelation. I did for many years. These passages, just a few of them, that say it's a record. It's like a journal entry. Each experience, which is soul making, gets laid down like on a hard drive. As a immortal, potentially immortal record, and they call it a transcript too. They call this with this very literal term of a transcript, but of course it's a different energetic reality.
Well, I mean, and, for all of us who carry around our smartphones and we record everything we do, it's almost like we have an internal DVR that is constantly on and constantly monitoring our mental activity and our experiences.
This is one of the questions that's not easy to address, and not really answered in my book. It's an area for research. There seems to be a recording of every moment of one's life, as distinct from a recording of every worthy treasure of your life. And as I was working on this book and going back and back and back to these passages in the UB, and comparing it to other source material we have about these sorts of things, it became clear that the life reviews that people have in these near-death experiences may not literally be their soul record. It may be the seraphim's record, the guardian.
Oh, you know, that's a good point. You're right. Okay.
Yeah, it's not so salient in the UB, but there's, you know, these passages that say, once you get to the third circle and you've made that level of maturity, then you get assigned your seraphim. But of course, and it says there's actually two of them, but one of them is in the background, and that's the recording seraphim. So they don't say much about it, but the seraphim is a powerful being, and how do they, you know, what are they doing? So it would seem that they're recording every moment. And I know that in some Edgar Cayce, followers of Edgar Cayce call us the Akashic Record or the Akasha. And Cayce said that there is sort of like these books that have every moment of your life in this library, so to speak. So I think that is sort of the library of the recording angel. And it may be that is what people see in the near-death experience, because many of them report that it's every moment of their life. So that's distinct from every soul-making moment. So I think that the thought adjuster is the other recording sort of device. And it's only selecting. It's selecting, sort of like an editor, really. It's selecting the best
the greatest clips. Hits. The greatest the hits clip. Of Byron Belton tonight.
Yeah, the greatest hits. There we go.
Yeah. So in a sense, some of the older religions do have it right when you think about karma. And not so much maybe that not every action has a direct reaction. The point being, obviously, that we are held accountable for our actions, but not so much accountable, but it's a process of learning how to make better decisions, correct? So when we are attempting to be more spiritual in our outlook or in our life, it really comes down to the decisions that we make on a day-to-day basis, right?
the decisions we make are what we're accountable for. And, you know, of course, we don't have the model of punishment that is in some of the karma teachings about karma, is that you're being sort of punished and they're going to send you back to kindergarten, you know, have a new life on earth so that you can learn your lessons and that you didn't learn the first time. And we don't really, you know, have that view in the UB and even in, you know, advanced Christianity, that it's a punitive universe. It's a friendly universe. And so, but what's also a little bit ironic about it is that it would appear to me that the thought adjuster is not simply selecting your best moments, like when I was really out there doing the great work and the shining and choosing truth, beauty, and goodness, and that's it, you know. It's also selecting your most poignant moments. But there are other moments when you're moving in the wrong direction and you're making decisions that are not good decisions and they're not particularly truthful, you know, moments in your life. But they're poignant in the sense of the word poignant, meaning they're important, they're powerful, and those go into the soul. I believe that those because that's you, that's how you are in this world. And so it's a depiction of your character, good, bad, and ugly. I have, you know, quibbles with other Urantia book interpreters on this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely up for debate and research. That as I read the Urantia text and other texts, the human soul, you know, if you're a sort of a dark character like Hitler, you know, you have a soul, and the soul has your dark decisions because they're your decisions. And if you went out of your way to make a bad decision,
mm-hmm.
that is part of the soul's profile.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, our minds are kind of like a continually growing database of all of our experiences and relationships, even including the bad ones. And I think maybe that's what. Because as I read the thought adjusters, and for those who don't know what that term means, it's exactly the same as the perfected spirit of God that, as Byron was saying, comes into you at the time of your first moral decision. So, but the thought adjuster is keeping record of these things as well.
It's keeping record of these things so that deity, God the Father, who's outside of space and time and outside of human experience, has a window in what it's like to be down here. And the Father's need to experience our lives, experience our experience, encompasses experiencing our adversity and experiencing our bad choices that all add up to, you know, the human endeavor to make it through this life. So they're not just into the smiley good things of your life. You know, it's not all happy news. And it's the news that counts. And if you decide to get into a marriage that's a bad marriage, that's part of the drama of your life that gets preserved in your life. Now, you know, there's the issue of, did you learn from that bad marriage?
Right.
But even if you were making mediocre decisions in the marriage, those are your decisions, and those have impact on the soul. Now, you might put it this way, that if they're low quality decisions, you're going to have a low quality soul. But if you had to make a lot of decisions, and if they weren't the world's greatest decisions, it still counts in your favor because you've had to deal with many degrees of problems and confronted many forms of adversity, and that does make the soul bigger because you've done a lot of things. But they weren't very high quality. But if you also make high quality decisions, and you have many of those decisions, that's the ideal, I think. And what I say in the book, and later in the book, is that they're looking for people that make a lot of decisions and that they're high quality decisions. But they'll accept people that make a lot of decisions that are not very high quality.
Mm-hmm.
You're just going to have to work on something different when you get to the afterlife.
I want to read a quote here because it's so well put, and it kind of leads into the next statement of conversation. Here we go. It says, God especially works through the medium of primary values. He ensures, for example, that beauty is clearly visible in our immediate environment. Because of the unmistakable presence of that which is attractive, God's human partners are aroused and awakened. For example, the aura of a lovely woman motivates ordinary man to unselfish and courage behavior. So what you're basically saying is, because of the fact that we have these personalities, because we are people, we are selves, and because God is the ultimate self, the original and even the bestower of personality, that's our connection. The fact that we can put value or appreciate beauty is really a godlike character, and that is more or less, would you say, proof that there is a divine being? And to me, that was a really standout line, that beauty is a clue. The fact that we appreciate bebeauty and truth and love truth and love each other is proof that there is something more than just physical going on.
In a way, you know, the presence of beauty is proof. It's, but I would call it intellectual proof, as opposed to sort of logical proof or spiritual proof. Or it's even spiritual proof, but it's proof that the mind can have a cognitive relationship with something that is self-transcending, and values that are pure values that motivate at the highest energy of reaching up. And so, yes, we're told that this is your best. Your best chance to cognitively understand the divine is by the perception of these primary values of truth, beauty, and goodness that are planted sort of in your environment to lure you upward and inward. So, you know, I think it's part of the divine design to provide these moments where we can recognize, and certainly where we can say, this is better than that. You know, these are the moral decisions we make. These are not decisions about truth, but decisions about what action to take in relation to another person. And the ability to discern the difference between a good act and a really good act, to really go into the deeper end of the pool of goodness, to forgive somebody who's hurt you, and forgive from the heart, that's to be able to recognize that choice is something that is a gift. It's transcendent. I call it self-transcending.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've gone into a lot of verbiage there. I hope I addressed your question.
No, you did. Absolutely. What motivated you to write the book, and how long did it actually take you to write the book from beginning to actually getting the ISBN number and getting it published?
I started on this subject in 1995. I wrote a short article that was published in a Urantia publication on the soul, and I had noticed, that there was a lot of talk about the soul in the 90s in psychology. Then I kind of put it aside, and the writing of the book took 3 years, the last 3 years, and one intensive year. In the end, to finish it up.
Was it hard for you to paraphrase? It's not easy to take some of the more complex concepts within the Urantia book and funnel it down. But even still, even in its simplicity, Byron, unless you're somewhat familiar, it can go right over your head. And you must have known that writing it. How do I get my point across without going over the audience's head?
Yeah, right. Well, you have audiences that you're targeting. I am targeting a fairly educated audience. I have been inspired to do a new book in a year or two. And that will be a little bit more simple and straightforward. And that should be for those who are more beginners with this kind of material.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to, you know, sort of target those who are more philosophic in this book, because those are the only folks that are really going to get down with the Urantia book in the end. If they're not philosophically inclined, they will not like it very mm-hmm. much, and they will not appreciate the distinctions that it makes.
The world of academics, and even in the world of psychology, there seems to be a secular shift away from anything that even smells like religion. Are you hopeful that this book will somehow make it to the level where it can be a discourse or a thesis for someone in some college somewhere?
It's making some inroads already, and that is part of the audience. Important part of my audience is academics, or to support academics, because I was an academic and there was no support for anybody on this subject matter. So, because there was no literature to cite, there was nobody to footnote, there was nobody writing at this level until recently. And those people need this, but I've had more than a few academics supporting this that are outside of our community, actually.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that today's religion lacks imagination?
I wouldn't say they lack imagination, but they lack, they're politicized, and they, from the beginning, you know, Christianity was politicized, and with the Gnostics got some essential truths that were very inconvenient for the powers that be, so they chopped those out, and they wanted to give a kind of a reduced, dumbed-down version of things. And they persecuted and rid the entire Mediterranean world of these deep thinkers. And so and I think so what you get in that scripture is not sufficient for the modern age to imagine who and what we are and where we're going. It's not even close, really, because we have so many advanced technologies and areas of knowledge now, but this lags far behind in its depth, specificity, in the quality of the distinctions that are made. It's really, really tardy and lacking. So we really need to upgrade that, and it's that's why I'm kind of assertive and aggressive with my work right now.
Mm-hmm.
Having been around, many decades watching the culture decline into so much confusion about why we're here, what we're doing, what's it all about, and people just resort to the lowest common denominator because they don't really have much to hang their hat on as to their spiritual life.
I tend to remain positive about the macro of the human experience, the big picture, and certainly the Urantia Revelation gives you a much broader scope and a much bigger, larger view of not only the universe, but our world and our lives and our cultures and how we evolved over time. But it's the micro of things that are bothersome, seeing the sort of tribalism that's emerging in America or around the world. Subgroups are starting to solidify and separate. In the macro world, do you worry that mankind is losing its soul, or are you encouraged that people still care about such things?
It's kind of both, we're kind of going up and we're going down at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There's this huge movement upwards, and it's being because of spiritual pressure from above, as is said in the Urantia book. But then there's this huge downward movement and sort of fragmentation, which is a result of the rejection of higher revelation in some degree, because the Urantia book, for example, has been more or less rejected by the current generation. So they're, and what do they have to fall back on? The Bible. Well, the Bible's really vague and out of date. It's also full of great truth. And so they kind of break into two groups: fundamentalists, which is a real big issue, obviously,
mm-hmm.
and those who just get really vague about their spirituality. And then, of course, there are the New Age folks who tend to distort and are very vague also and very fragmented. So where do you turn? In a way, you can't blame people for being so, despairing and turning to false prophets. We're going to self-destruct because we don't have the values embedded in our culture that can deal with the power of the technology.
Yeah.
You know, I had surgery last week, and I was pretty amazed at how I knew going in it was going to be like this, but it was really extreme. They had almost no human touch to this thing. It was just cut this guy up and spit him out. And it was really upsetting and angered me. And I didn't go in naive about this.
Mm-hmm.
We're destroying ourselves all the time, and we are not going to make it 1,000 years without an update of these values. So I just really, like you, worry about the current moment. But we know that our Creator Son, as in the Urantia book, Christ Michael, mm-hmm. is going to protect his planet in the long term and will pull us through.
He's got a vested
interest.
There's
enough of us.
Right?
He's got a vested interest mm-hmm. in all of his children and in particular this planet. So, each generation that sort of dies off, gets rehabilitated in the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
but if a generation can grow up and show up and wake up in this life, I mean, that is the goal. Mm-hmm. And that will happen. It may not be this generation. It doesn't look very good right now.
Social media, I can't tell if it's a reflection of our worst side or a contribution to our better natures. I can't figure out which is ahead in that race. And again, there have been so many social upheavals in the last 40, 50 years. What is it, the quote? It's not exact, but it says there's been more change in our lifetime than all of the previous generations combined. So it's not without one to speculate that maybe the Urantia book arrived when it did, because intellectually we're far in advance of where we used to be in all the sciences, except for our spiritual understanding. That seems to be the one area. And you talk about the triad in your book about the soul, about the three important elements of the soul.
The triad, as I call it, the inner triad,
mm-hmm.
Is at the top of it is the personality, then the spirit, the God fragment. This is really in status, in mm-hmm. cosmic status. The personality is prior to the spirit, and
right.
the spirit is prior to the soul. So those three together work as a trio, but they're not equal.
mm-hmm.
They're not exactly equal partners. And getting that set of distinctions into psychology, psychiatry, even things like medicine, would revolutionize those fields and pole vault us forward. So in a way, all of us are in the same boat of trying to bring these distinctions to the world in a mission of a clarification
mm-hmm.
of who we are and where we're, why we're here, what we're doing, and who are our creators, and mm-hmm. what is their design of the human self.
It's
essential knowledge.
There's a great line, Byron, in your book. I love this. I'm going to read it to you. I've never heard it before, but it made a heck of a lot of sense when you said it. It said, God does not owe us continued existence if we refuse to accept the purpose of existence. It's our decision. It's not carte blanche. How do you think psychiatry today is getting it wrong about the human self? Because it seems like the emphasis is on treatment and medication. What is missing in psychiatry, which is so prevalent in our world today? What are they missing when they seek to attempt to understand and define and treat the human personality?
All the things we're talking about are missing, they're missing a concept of the self that is spiritual as it was at the root. And the root of psychiatry comes from this word sihi, which means soul.
Psych.
They have given up that the soul exists. They have no concept of the soul. If they use the word, they use it in a very vague way. But in mainstream psychiatry, it's just the brain. It's just the biochemical aspects of the brain. the dynamics of what's happening in the synapses, the material connections that are being made are reign over the entire field and neuroscience in general. And of course, these are really important contributions at that level, but they're way out of whack when we don't coordinate them with these higher attributes of the self. They're missing the meaning of this, and it's because their training is completely reductionistic and materialistic.
Mm-hmm.
It's an appalling situation that it's turning around, but very slowly.
How can we find out more about you, Byron Beletsos?
I have a site. It's evolving-souls, S-O-U-L-S, souls.org. And just come there and sign up. I'm doing my own sort of radio interviews as well. It's called Evolving Souls Podcasts. But I'm circulating and speaking and happy to come to speak to any community in the country.
Okay, so it's evolving-souls.org. Byron, it's been a real pleasure catching up with you and talking to you today.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much again, and I look forward to being back in this conversation.
Once again, thanking Byron Beletsos, our guest on Candidly Speaking, author of the book, Your Evolving Soul, The Cosmic Spirituality of the Urantia Revelation.